This episode of Comic Dorks is brought to you by patreon.com/frogpants. If you like Comic Dorks and other shows on the Frog Pants Network, there's never been a better way than to throw a little scratch our direction at patreon.com/frogpants.
Presenting a new exciting radio program featuring the thrilling adventures of
Comic Dorks.
Thrilling adventure, intense excitement, pounding action, and spine-tingling mystery.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Comic Dorks. This is Comic Dorks, episode 22, and it is Tuesday, September 30th, 2014. Back for a brand new show, episode of the show. Good to have everybody here. Let's go around the table. It's Scott Kurtz over there. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. We got Mark Spagnuolo right over there.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, man. And Stephen K. Schleicher III right over there.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, man. It's good to see everybody and have us here and do the thing.
We're all here at the same time.
Right. Isn't that great?
What's up with that?
I don't know. I feel like I'm living a charmed life today.
I gotta go, guys.
Scott's got a probably another con to go to or something. Busy man. Con season's over, though, right? You're done.
Yeah, I was actually done after PAX Prime, but we did go to Rose City Comic Con because it's in Portland and it's not very far away. And the guy that runs Emerald City gave me a table as a guest, so I was when people offer you a free table, it's kind of, and it's pretty local. It's just a good manners to accept it.
People like Rose City too. They're I've heard good things about that con. Not too big, not too small, just a nice little artist friendly thing. Is that true?
Well, it's not artist friendly.
No,
but it's it was pretty dead. Well, let me put it a different way. It was a busy show. Lots of people walking around. Lots of Portlandians excited to have a show. There used to be a show there that was very indie comic scene called Stumptown that I think a lot of the artists wish was back. But Rose City is more of a mainstream con. It's kind of being run by the guys who do Emerald City now, and a lot of media guests. And there's not a lot of spending going on.
Yeah.
But that could also be because it's Portland.
Sure.
And everyone's a broke hipster.
They're saving their money for those donuts or whatever it is they're famous for.
Or coffee or whatever, yeah.
Sure.
I mean, just not a lot of buying going on.
Skinny pants. I know how it goes. Well, good. Well, we're glad to have you back. Glad to have everybody here. Let's jump right into some of this here news we got going on.
Wait a minute. Don't leave me here alone. I'll talk. I'll tell you everything I know.
The Marvel and Kirby estate settlement. That happened. And
out of nowhere.
It kind
of
did. And do we...
don't know anything.
So we don't know if it's equitable. We don't know if it was good for either side. We don't know anything except that it happened out of public
eye. They released a joint statement that said we're happy with the result.
Yeah.
And that's it. And we'll never probably know what that settlement is.
Give us some history. What was the original beef?
They wanted the Kirby estate wanted back control of properties that Jack had created when he was working for Marvel and that's where the crazy part gets in is. And that was Marvel's whole argument was, well, he doesn't own any of this stuff because he was a work for hire. And it really got into a big case of work for hire. And where does this all fall out? And it was all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had, I think, until the end of October to decide if they were going to weigh in on this. But before they could even sit down and look at it, the Kirby estate, Marvel sat down, and more importantly, Disney sat down with Kirby estate, and they hashed it all out. Now the Supreme Court doesn't even hear it, which is, I guess, kind of good and kind of bad. Because
why bad?
Well, if it had gone up to the Supreme Court, we would have gotten a clearer ruling over ownership of work for hire and clarifications on work for hire. And, that would have been really good for creators. On the bad side, you don't think so?
What if it wasn't in his favor?
Well, no, but I'm saying there were some indications, and especially, I had a lawyer on one of our shows a couple of months ago when it was first being pushed up to the Supreme Court, and she kind of agreed that there was a lot of skeeviness going on at the publisher's side, and that if it does go up to the Supreme Court, she kind of thought that it would rule in favor of the Kirby estate.
Scott Kurtz, thoughts?
It was not going to. Well, when you say it was going to help creators, it certainly would have changed things. And there's a reason why. I think it was the Directors Guild, or was it the Screen Actors Guild?
Screen Actors Guild.
Screen Actors Guild of America was like put in there, kind of like, we're behind the Kirby estate on this. And it's because, look, it's like the Hobby Lobby thing, right? When the Hobby Lobby thing happened at the Supreme Court level, everyone was like, well, this is shit. And that's not the people that were upset about that decision that Hobby Lobby was allowed to say that their corporation has religious beliefs was that there was fear a precedent was being set that corporations were people. And that what that would mean, not for Hobby Lobby, not for this particular decision, but for in the future when any other organizations decides they get to be people and when how that will be negative.
Right.
So what the Kirby filing or the Kirby case going to the Supreme Court, what everyone was hoping on the Kirby estate side, people that were supporting it, they were hoping that this would call into question all this previous work for hire shit that's been going on for years. So imagine if you helped write a screenplay to Star Wars and it was work for hire, but now this Kirby thing has set precedent and maybe it wasn't work for hire. Mm. Maybe you do get a percentage of Star Wars profits now.
Yeah.
So it wasn't going to help any creators moving forward because
they just lock that stuff down.
A lot of that stuff is taken care of today.
Well, it's like whenever, yeah.
Well, when it comes to like Ghost Rider, when it comes to Howard the Duck, doesn't that help? Wouldn't that help some of those creators?
Well, Steve Gerber's dead, so it wouldn't help him.
Right.
It would help. It doesn't help Jack Kirby either, by the way. None of this helps Jack Kirby because motherfucker's dead.
Right.
But
right.
It certainly helped his grandkids.
Yeah.
And that's what this is really all about. Because as you can tell, now that they have their money, they don't give a shit about precedent being set. They're still not championing it for the Supreme Court. They don't give a fuck about other people's creators' rights. They got their money and they're done.
Yeah.
So that does bring up a kind of a good, and I'm interested to hear everybody's kind of thoughts on this, because now that decision was announced or the settlement was announced, there have suddenly become two camps that have split off from this. One that says, oh, Kirby would be rolling in his grave if he knew that his kids gave up, gave in and just took all the money. And then there's another camp that says, hey, Kirby was really concerned about making sure that his family had money going forward. And this gives them that money that he would have wanted.
Well, sure. That argument is absolutely going to be made. But to me, it's like this. And this is where it gets a little weird to me. So let's say I'm going to use Mark. You're my example.
Okay.
You build the White House calls and said, hey, we want to commission you work for hire one time only. We want you to make a big wooden horse and we're going to put it somewhere in the White House. And we just want it to be decorative, and we're going to pay you handsomely for it. It's going to, you know, we're going to give you $30,000 for this thing. What do you think? And you go, great, that sounds awesome. And you kind of sign up. Everyone's intentions are clear. They get the big wooden horse down at the White House. You finished it. It's beautiful. It's sitting there. This is going to get a little convoluted, but somebody attacks the White House. All right. Olympus Has Fallen style, right?
I've seen that movie.
This movie sucks.
It happens, guys. It's happened twice.
It has happened a couple times.
In 1 year.
So, yeah, it was like Deep Impact Armageddon time for those movies. But anyway, so they do this and there's an attack. And part of it is the horse is damaged in such a way that it actually produces this incredibly patriotic image of something with the horse. And it becomes so indelible and so in our minds now and is so tied to that horrible day. Yet our unity and our vision moving forward as a nation, that room is cordoned off and hardly touched and not fixed because they want people to always remember what happened in there with your horse. And now, as it turns out, they can charge crazy fees for people to come tour that thing, have their pictures taken with it. And for the next 30 to 50 years, getting your picture with that horse is $20 a pop and is this amazing thing. And it makes billions and billions of dollars in revenue, let's say, or even just millions. Mm. Should Mark, in that, given that, you know, retrospective, being able to look back on it now and say, well, look what did happen, not what was intended to happen, but what did happen, do you feel like you should have rights to say, look, I want some of this scratch? That's, you wouldn't even have this room if it wasn't for my damn horse.
I think so. And it kind of depends on how this thing was agreed upon in the first place. And a lot of times this is taken care of in current contracts that are made. Am I Mark working for a company they hired? Am I just staff? that's working for a company, for instance, some designer that works for IKEA, for instance, is that designer going to get credit for that forever? I don't know. What contract did he sign before he started working there? But if they commissioned me as an individual because they know I have the skill to do this project, that I would hope would be something that would be accounted for in my contract for any future things that happen because they came to me. So, you know, I don't know much about Jack Kirby historically, but if he were just staff and sort of quote air quotes on that, if he were just staff at the time that these things were created, it's a little harder to say he's deserving of these things, even though it makes tons of money now. I think it's a little harder to make the argument because he was under that sort of staff umbrella. But Jack Kirby, the legend that he is today, we feel differently about it because of who he became.
Well, it's because he's the legend, right? Like, so he's the IKEA employee in your scenario, but he gained all this, like,
he became bigger,
notoriety for being
bigger than IKEA.
Yeah, yeah. Point, it's like, know? Sven Olderlafner over there at IKEA just made a hell of a table once. And, you know, that, and then suddenly he got this new status. So the question is, did they get the settlement and they're both happy with the settlement and get a settlement at all? Because that carried sway with the court that this is Jack Kirby, dude, what created a bunch of these characters or co-created a bunch of these important characters. I don't know the answer to that, but it feels like that to me. It feels like celebrity matters in issues of law.
Certainly. It's,
no, I mean, look, the only thing that this has gone to court before. Okay. It's gone to court, not the Supreme Court, but it's gone to court before. And, basically, what the Kirby estate did at one point was say, we don't agree that these characters were created under the Copyright Act of 1970, whatever, seven it is.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then my grandfather, the copyright will revert. And so we're suing for our copyright back. And it was decided that they didn't own the copyright ever, so they don't get it reverted back. So now they want to take it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, I don't think the Supreme Court is going to take into consideration Jack Kirby's celebrity status. I mean, certainly history at the time when Jack signed those contracts, and at one point Jack had his own company and he had other creators sign similar contracts. So it's not like Jack didn't know what the hell was going on. It's the question is the big debate, especially among comic fans and other creators, is a legal versus moral one,
right?
Because legally it's you know,
black and white,
pretty black and white, but morally it's different, right? So that's where we get in trouble. And when I say we, I mean me, because when I speak out against this, when I say it's more complicated than, well, they're making a lot of money now, and Jack Kirby never got any of it, so give the money to his kids. It's just such a childish.
It's just an easy surface way to look at
it. It's just such a childish way to look at the problem.
Yeah. It's deeper than that. Everything always is. I can't stand it when these things are surmised into some little simple, easy to digest thing. I always feel like I'm being fooled with when I think that's what I'm being presented. And this is definitely more complicated than that. Nobody's saying that his legacy, I mean, his legacy as the artist and as the creator should be honored, surely. That's a separate issue from what was he contractually obligated to receive for his work.
And it spills over onto Stan, too, because everyone feels like, you know, at the time, the way that they were pumping these comics out, you know, Stan would come and go, oh, he's a kid and he gets bitten by a radioactive spider and he picks up a hammer and he's Spider Thor. And then Jack would take it and go, well, let's leave the hammer out. We'll make that a separate character. And then everyone gets pissed because Stan says he co-created Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know,
I wouldn't mind Spider Thor if you're asking, though. That's an all right amalgam. I'd do it.
I'd read it.
I think they've done it at least once, probably.
Any guesses as to who got what money, though? Because we don't have any idea. So if you were just to venture a guess in today's dollars, what did the Kirby estate walk away with in the settlement? Does anyone have a guess?
Oh, they probably got a percentage of.
Think that's how they did it?
They probably got a percentage.
That would be the smart way. They've got Toberoff. Toberoff was their lawyer, so I'm sure they're getting a percentage.
Is he known for
getting
percentages?
Well, he's known for many things. The most recently, he was He was representing the Seagulls and Schuster's in the Superman thing. But
I didn't realize that was the same guy.
He's the guy that essentially had, was it the Seagulls or the Schuster estate? I forget which one, sign over their portion of the Superman rights to him to oversee. And so basically he becomes the controller of that.
That's weird.
So yeah. Yeah. It's.
So does he specialize in shystery comic book only law copyrights?
He's good at it.
Yeah, he's really good at it.
Huh. Well, good for him. Somebody won. I don't know who won in this whole deal, but probably equates to millions and maybe tens of millions is my guess.
I would bet it's probably a little bit higher than that if they're counting in the billions of dollars that have been brought in from the movie franchise.
Sure. I just say it sucks. It sucks for Jack because he, like Scott says, not here, dead, can't benefit from the thing he actually did, and his snotty-nosed grandkid never did. I'm sure he may be a fine kid.
Listen, I don't know these people. I don't know the heirs to Jack Kirby. It's like this happens every time, and it's like when my dad was going through his divorce, we went and saw his financial planner. And my dad is very, very big on leaving me and my brother money. It's everything that he invests with his money is that when he dies, the boys get something.
Yeah.
And the financial planner was trying to explain to us this. And he's like, you know, your dad's his legacy is very important to him. And, you know, I'm trying to help your dad with his legacy. And I said, hey, I'm in charge of my dad's legacy. You're in charge of his money.
Mm.
And, you know, the same thing happened with Frazetta. You know, when Frazetta got super old, his kids just started fighting over all of his shit and drove a backhoe into his fucking studio and tried to steal art. And it's like I miss Grandpa's money. You know what I mean? It's like, does anybody miss the guy? Like, this is all that he is.
Yeah. That's a good point. But there's always going to be this automatic, the man is trying to screw the little guy mentality.
Yeah, but no one really knows how much money they have or how much they're hurting or,
well, it's because they're not telling anybody. That's the problem with all this is if they want to fight this out sort of in a non-public but public way, and we don't know any details about anything. You know?
Well, it's settled now. And we can all put it behind us.
We'll never know what that settlement
is. No, why would they say? You got to get one of those grandkids drunk at some party, and then he'll spill the beans. Speaking of spill the beans, Dave Dorman's wife and cosplayers was a thing that came up.
Unfortunately.
Who knows the story behind this? Who wants to explain? Steven, are you aware of the details?
Well, I am, and I've kind of read through it, and I've kind of just like, well, this is one person's opinion on what she feels about what's going on at the conventions. And she talks about some problems about how much, well, I wouldn't say problems, but talking about how much her husband Dave is making at a convention. And she does have this in bold on the website. I have slowly come to realize that in this selfie obsessed Instagram era, cosplay is the new focus of these conventions, seeing and being seen. And that is the statement that everyone has latched onto. And said, what cosplayers are to blame for this? How dare she?
Well, let's look at it this the way I would see that. I'm not sure this is her intent, but by the way I read that statement, is that the cosplay has become a force at these things. But not because there's some nefarious design or conspiracy afoot. It's just what people are really into right now.
Mm-hmm. And she goes on to say, conventions are no longer shows about commerce, product launches, and celebrating the people who created the genre in the first place. And she goes on and talks about that.
Well, sure, but Pearl Harbor is no longer a place to get killed. It's a place to go look at an old ship and wonder what the hell happened when your grandpa was alive. You know what I mean?
Right. I think it's interesting.
It's a bad comparison.
It's difficult for – there's a lot – what's happening is this, okay? And a lot of creators are having trouble with it. And there's this weird phenomenon that happens at comic book conventions, especially with – exhibitors and creators, is inevitably you're going to walk around to someone else's booth and you're going to say, how's the show going? And everyone's going to start lying to each other about how the show is going. No one ever just goes, I'm taking a bath this year. Everyone's doing great. You know, everyone's kicking ass. And it's just this weird dance that happens. But what's happening now is that everyone is secretly going home that's been going to comic book conventions for a long time, and it's been a big part of their income. They're going home and they're saying, God, am I just not relevant anymore? No one cares that I'm here. And it's not a matter even of God, I'm just not making the money I used to. It's that no one cares that you're there. It's the last San Diego I went to, which was not this year. It was last year. I had the easiest setup ever. We Love Fine ran my entire booth. All I had to do was show up for signings. My stuff was selling. People were coming up and going, I want that shirt and I want that poster. And oh my God, I want that little toy. And the guy that runs We Love Fine would say, hey, do you want Scott to sign it? And they would look at him like he was crazy. Like, no, I don't want this guy to draw on my thing I'm buying. He's like, well, that's the cartoonist. Well, what do you mean? Well, that's a that poster there, that's from a comic strip. And this is the guy that draws a comic strip. And they're like, can I have my fucking change, please? Because I've got to get to Hall H. They like the poster.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. They're excited to hang it up. They do not give a shit who drew it.
Yeah.
Geek culture has become pop culture.
Yeah.
And it's not a culture of comic book enthusiasts anymore. It's a culture of mainstream America getting into this. It's become pop culture. They love the keys. These kids love the Avengers. So what's happening is you have a lot of old school comic guys and even younger comic guys that just were looking forward to the dignity of what would be essentially a book fair. You're a creator. You're a storyteller. You're there to meet fans of your work. And what's happening with conventions now is they keep bringing in comic book creators at the same time that these shows. What's bringing all the money in is the carnival. Dylan mm-hmm. McConis, my writer on co-writer on PvP, she put it great. You can't run a book fair and a carnival in the same space and expect both to thrive. And that's what's happening right now. So the cosplaying is not bad. And I don't think Dave Dorman's wife is even saying the cosplaying is bad.
No, but I don't think she is either.
That's the carnival aspect. You dress up, you go to the carnival, you walk around, you see all the booths. You see all the cosplay. You go to a couple panels. You take pictures. It's a day at the fair. It's a day at the Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. You meet some media guests. Maybe you don't pay for a photo, but you can still walk over there and see that's Sean Astin sitting right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
and you spent $100 to get your family in, and that's it. That's all you're spending except for food and parking. That's it.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say is I wonder if there's – I mean, the economics of going to a convention is – out of this world, because if you do go to even a small convention today, it's $60 to get in for a day or a weekend.
It is.
And then if you want to go and get one autograph, depending on who that autograph is, that can range anywhere from $20 to $200. And then if you do want to go out and buy some cool merchandise, you know, you're paying me personally, I can blow through $500 in an hour at a good convention. And then you want, then somebody else is there wanting to sell their wares, and I just don't have the money to do it. It's interesting because I went to the Planet Comic Con last year up in Kansas City, and I was walking down the aisle, and who's sitting there but Don Rosa? And I was like, holy crap, that's Don Rosa. You know, Scrooge McDuck, Don Rosa. And there was one person, one little kid at the table that he was talking to.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, you know, he's taking the time to talk to this little kid. This kid is going to have a great memory. And then I turn the corner and there's 300 people lined up to see, you know, some Star Trek personality that was there. There were a lot of them there, but, you know, there's 300 people lined up to see Q, 300 people lined up to see Will Wheaton, 300 people lined up to see, you know, Dr. Crusher.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of people are feeling. That's why I get so upset when Dave Dorman's wife writes down something and no one has enough reading retention to read between the lines and understand they just want something to be pissed off about today because that's their only creative outlet. Mm-hmm. So she said cosplayers. And look, I like it when other people dress up. I don't like dressing up. But when I go and sit down at the cosplaying grates on my nerves a little bit. And we love the costumes because when we were at Rose City even, Corey and I, who are super into Arrow, there was a lady dressed up as Lady Deathstrike. Mm-hmm. Just awesome. Straight out of the comic. including the big pirate, the big bell bottom boots.
Oh, sweet.
With the wig and the eye patch. I mean, we called her over. It was like, God, that's how long did it take you to make that costume, et cetera, et cetera. Then there was a guy walking around. I guess he was supposed to be Uncle Fester. We didn't realize it until he put a bulb in his mouth, you know, that that's what he was supposed to be. But most of the day he was the creepy guy in just like a black robe and gray face paint. And it was just like, and then there was, we had a joke. There was one lady, she had to be like almost pushing 60, dressed up as Jessica Rabbit. And she had that when you get older and you kind of get boobs on your back.
Oh.
You know what I mean? The back boobs.
Yeah.
I mean, no offense. I probably got them at 43. I have not taken a look on what's behind me right now, but it's not going to be pretty. But I'm not dressing up as Jessica Rabbit. So, but we were walking past, and I'm like, we're like, please don't come over to our booth. Please don't come over to our booth. And it's like, oh, you're dressed up as Jessica Rabbit. No, I'm Kathleen Turner. Oh, you're dressed up as Kathleen Turner. No, I'm Kathleen Turner. That was our joke for her, but like, I could do without that.
Sure,
you know what I mean. And there's nothing wrong with her being there, wine dressed up as Jessica Rabbit. That's awesome. Yeah. But it's just like, it's just a weird. Like, if it was just that, if it was just the cosplaying and the spectacle, thumbs up. I'm in. Let's go. But when you're sitting there and you're like, there's this carnival happening, and then like, what do you do? What do you do? Do you juggle? What's your costume? And you're like, I draw comics. And they're like, oh, people draw these?
What are you doing here?
Yeah, I thought a computer made these.
That's what I'm saying is that's what these creators are feeling. So you can mock them on Twitter. You can go and make fun of them. And you can make it about something it's not. But a lot of these creators are going home and going, God, I guess no one gives a shit that we make the comics anymore.
Well,
and it's a real thing.
Yeah.
She has this question at the end where she says, so I ask you, at what point would you cut bait and stop attending these shows? How do we satisfy the fans in a way that makes sound financial sense?
Okay, well, here, I have an answer for this.
Okay.
So I think this works, and I've thought about it for a while. So, Mark, you hate it when I do that. Or maybe you don't hate this, but I'm going to use you again as an example because for whatever reason, the wood thing works
Mark,
for me.
Mark, you make a statue.
No, well, it's even easier
than
that.
It's in the Vatican. The Vatican is invaded by aliens now.
I like this story already. No, this is even more. This is more down to earth. So there are likely big, giant homeware-like convention-y kind of things where they fill up a giant convention hall, and it's everything from kitchen sinks to toilets to, you know, brands of cabinetry and all that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are small and you could go there. You could booth there. You could show off your stuff there. But you would be a guy who makes things out of wood. Really nice things. But you're going to be overshadowed by the quote unquote carnival Scott's talking about in that arena. So instead, what do? You start to see pop up these woodworking conventions that are all about the smaller focused, gourmet woodworker guys. Making really neat stuff. And there, you're still the superstar who makes the stuff, but you're also surrounded by your peers and you're surrounded by a situation that seems to sort of grow that and feed into that whole, we're making cool stuff and we're not part of big manufacturing or whatever.
Yeah.
The same thing, I think, could happen to comics, where suddenly these conventions, San Diego and everywhere else, that starts to look so much like a carnival and enough creators are starting to verbally say, even though they kind of all pretend they're having a great time, they all start to say to each other, is this working for us? Is it working for you? Well, oh, it's not for me neither. And then they go do their own thing.
Well, and that was the secondary argument that spun out of this, in that a lot of people started saying, well, maybe it's part of the fault is, and maybe not fault is not the right word, but part of it is the labeling of a convention. Like Fan Expo is a lot different than Comic-Con. But people are wondering if shows that are more fan carnival oriented, as Scott Kurtz said, should be using comic convention in their title if that's not misleading to a lot of people.
Well, they're also nearly identical. We had a Fan X here and we had a normal Comic-Con. And guess what the difference was? Nothing I could see was different. Mm. It was still like, hey, welcome Lou Ferrigno. And there's Artist Alley over there. And there's just not a big difference every time.
This is where I'm going to disagree with Mrs. Dorman is I don't think that, I don't think that anything needs to be done to fix thing, so it's okay for creators again. I mean, it is what it is. It's going to change. And I mean, it's, I guess it's a net positive, right? Because if you go look in Japan, comics are not this niche culture, right? Like, I know what it is they want to come back. I don't know that I necessarily want it to come back. I like the idea that comics are sold in grocery stores and are cheaper and aren't like a specialty item. I don't know that I necessarily want to be the 70s or the 80s again when it comes to this stuff.
But couldn't it be a new thing where creators are...
It can be, but the another problem is that the popularity of it means that more of these cons are going to pop up, and the more cons there are in a year, I mean, there's just so many of them now, you're spreading out. I mean, if there's only six cons, people are going to travel. But if there's a con in every show, the show you go to is going to have less people in it to spend.
Yeah.
Scott, let me ask you a question. As you travel these shows, how much of your, I don't know, satisfaction and identity for who you are as a creator comes from those live interactions versus what you can create by building your own communities online, for instance, and maybe popping into a show once in a while?
Well, first, let me say that I'm not unaware of my, I'm breathing rarefied air here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just in a different situation than a lot of creators. You know, PvP is a very different entity. It has a built-in audience, and I get to go to a couple conventions that are just catered specifically to me. I mean, I made maybe $1,000 at Rose City Comic Con, mm-hmm. but I could gross 10 at a PAX.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but PAX is a convention that's distilled down to just my readers.
Right.
I mean, it used to be that you could make that at a San Diego, but you can't anymore. Now, keep in mind, I'm also running a bigger business and it's a different thing, but when I go to a comic book convention, like I'm going to go to Emerald City in April and I'll do okay. But I won't do like I do at a PAX or a Gen Con, because those are conventions catered specifically to what it is I make with audiences that know who I am.
Yeah.
So I still have those cons. Like, it used to be a comic convention was where you go to meet the creators. So it was great if you were Dave Dorman or you were Adam Hughes or, you know, someone like that, because that's where the people went to meet you. It was the one time of a year you got your thing.
Yeah,
I still have those.
It seems like they just have to be a little more strategic now about evaluating these events, what they offer for the creator, and finding a way to either attend the event and make your own meetups if you really want to find your hardcore fans, or just do things a little differently. I mean, there's nothing you could do to change this.
There's a reason I started Nerdtacular is this very question. The whole entire point was, I could go to these cons and I could meet people and I'll see some fans, and BlizzCon's a big deal and I can see people there and all that. But doing my own thing has been far more to what my goals were, which is make
true, but
you know,
but what you're you can't suggest that to.
Well, I realize
because what you're not even because I mean honestly, I could run a Nerdtacular. I don't think anyone would fucking show up.
I'd go.
Me too.
I'd come. Comic Dorks.
Oh, shit. Well, shit, guys, let's do it. No. what I'm saying is, it's like when any of the syndicated cartoonists come up to me and go, I want to do what you do, you know, how do you start? And you're basically asking them to start over at 50 or 60. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Nerdtacular wasn't always what it is now. It's been how many years now?
This will be 2015, or next year will be 8 years.
Yeah. So it's been 8 years of building up to this.
Sure. Yeah. No, right. Totally, so, absolutely true.
You can't tell Dave Dorman, just start your own con, and in 8 years...
Yeah, no, it's not it's definitely not the answer. I was more speaking to the whole, my experience, and it was almost by luck, has been that that's how I best connected with my people. And that it turns out not everybody obviously can do that, even if they're huge. I mean, you could even be, I would argue, if you're, let's say you're William Shatner or Stan Lee, and if you said, hey, I'm starting the Stan Lee Con next year, you'd get a lot of relative bunch of people, but it wouldn't be San Diego.
It used to be that.
Did it really?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like San Diego Comic Con was basically Stan Lee Con?
No, there was a series of conventions that were Stan Lee's Heroes Con or something.
Yeah, it's still going on, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, is that still a thing? Well, bad example then. Maybe he's not the right one to think. But, you know, take somebody like, I don't know, I can't think of an artist at the moment. It's not popping in my head. But just some, you know, big comic art. Take McFarlane, who's got the money and the wherewithal, if he wanted to have, you know, Spawn Con. It wouldn't be San Diego.
No.
But maybe it doesn't need to be. The point is you get this more engaged, smaller, more intense group. Maybe that's all I'm getting at, is that if there was a way for things like this thing you talked about in Portland, you wish was still there, the indie thing. More of
Stumptown,
those.
Right?
Yeah, Stumptown. More of those that catered to maybe a smaller group, but a very intense, very willing to part with their money for what they love group.
Well, even if people aren't being recognized, let's say, as the artist, if stuff is still selling, I mean, and is it, would you say, in general, for people like Dorman, are they still selling and able to make money? Like, with this new influx of people, you'd think there's at least a percentage of them who are going to buy. So the net gain is more than it was before.
So it says here
that's more of a question.
Dave was exhibiting at Grand Con, and yesterday he ended the day with $40. Today, Saturday at 12:30, he's only made $20 so far.
Okay, so it sounds
keep in mind that, like, yeah, I mean, Adam Hughes, who is one of the most famous cover artists for Marvel and DC ever, you know, his wife was talking about how they went home after a con and went, God, maybe Adam's not relevant anymore. But the difference is Adam's work has probably never been more popular. It's just that the climate is changing where there's less people that want to go buy a pinup or a commission. Yeah. They just want to enjoy. You know what I mean? Like, more people, where it should trickle down is that there's more comics being sold. That's the other problem, right? The other problem is these movies aren't making comics more popular. They're just making comic book movies more popular.
Yeah,
they're making the brand more popular.
You'll have a fit and a start with something like Guardians of the Galaxies will shoot to number one on comic, you know, lists for a couple of months, but it's not a sustained thing. It's not.
Well,
like converted a bunch of people.
It's making those licenses more popular.
Sure.
But it's not. No one's buying more Guardians of the Galaxies comics.
Well, look at it this way. If you're an artist for Guardians of the Galaxy and you're parked at a con and some kid comes to the con, in the old days, let's say in the 80s or 70s, and again, you know, I'm just using from what I know, but you would buy a print or a pinup or something because that was your way to get extended something from something you loved. Their reference point is the movie in the first place, and their $20 is going to the Blu-ray.
Right.
They don't care.
Or the toys.
Yeah, they don't care about the primordial ooze that built this thing way back in Grandpa's day. They want the thing that's happening now. And when we were kids, there was no thing happening now. The pinup was our best shot at something happening now.
The Marvel movies are making superheroes more popular. They're not making comics more popular. And that's turning Comic-Cons into something different. Mm. And the show promoters know that the money is in photos. You here's how it works. You have someone like Sean Astin, okay? What was the last thing Sean Astin? He's doing The Strain now, but the last thing he was in was Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and then before that, all I cared about was Rudy.
Right, or Goonies. Okay. Sean Astin is going to come to a comic convention in your town. You're a promoter. So you call his agent and you say, we'd like to have Sean at the show. The agent says, great. Sean is going to sell photos for $40. Okay. And he's also going to sell an opportunity for you to take a photo with him for $75.
Yeah.
The photographer gets $10. The photographer gets $10. The show gets $10. Sean gets the rest. Sean is offered a guarantee, meaning he is guaranteed, say, $10,000.
Yeah.
Okay. If Sean doesn't make $10,000 in selling photos and taking $10 or whatever, $20 of the photo, then you will pay his guarantee. More famous actors get higher guarantees. So if you're going to have William Shatner out there, you're going to have a higher guarantee for Shatner than you're going to have Boomer from the original Battlestar Galactica. But yeah, everyone is offered a guarantee. In fact, Erin Gray, who used to be on Buck Rogers, she started a company repping all these people to conventions.
I had heard about that. Yeah.
Right. So
It's a good move. That's like that's like Fred Savage directing.
But that's where all the money at the cons is right now for the promoters.
Yeah.
If you're smart and there was a convention runner in Dallas, you'll start a side business where you sell signed celebrity photos. And part of the contract is before they leave, they sign a bunch of photos that you get to keep. And then you sell them online when you're not running shows. But it's getting to a point where the promoters now are actually part of the photo taking crew. Just, there might even be some double dip. Not that it's shady or anything. I'm just saying that's the business.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, if you say half the crew from Firefly is going to be at the convention center, that's going to get people in the door. So if Batista is going to be there and he was just in Guardians of the Galaxy, you can end up with 20 to 40,000 people coming through your door, all of them paying parking, all of them paying ticket prices, plus they're paying for photos possibly. But that's what the show is, which is fine. And I'm on board with it. I love that shit. But that's not helping comic creators. That's not what a comic con is. Well, I mean, it is what a comic con is now. But what I'm saying is that's not a show where people go to meet people who make comic books.
Yeah.
So it's changing and everyone's got to adapt and there's some growing pains. But to throw Dave Dorman's wife under the bus that she's some anti-cosplayer, just fucking...
That's internet crap, though.
It's the noise to the signal, guys.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right about that. And look, yeah, whatever. The way this thing will shake out, as I speaking of Portland ideas, comic book creators might be the new vinyl at some point. You know? Like, and I mean it. Like, they'll have a smaller sort of curated little space that is okay to be in, and maybe they'll get better. They'll have better traction there overall because the audience who comes to that or pays attention to that does really care. I don't think that's a bad thing.
There's a reason why the comic book conventions I go to now are local. Mm-hmm. I don't go to Baltimore anymore. I don't go to Heroes Con.
Yeah.
Great shows. I love them, but it's going to be very difficult for me to make back my money going to Baltimore or Charlotte when I can do Emerald City, which is local, and I can drive to Portland, which is a 3-hour drive away, yeah, and stay with my friend.
I've got a friend with 1.6 million Twitter followers and said something to me once that really stuck with me, which was, I would kill to have 20,000 Twitter followers that were all engaged.
That, you know what? Yep. It's the Dave Kellett effect, dude.
Yeah.
I would kill for half of Dave Kellett's audience because they just... they want to spend money. Yeah. They love it and they want to spend money and support them.
Yeah,
and amazing. Look, there's a reason why I'm putting up a Patreon for PvP and Table Titans, because here's something else that's changing about cons before we let this subject drop. And everyone that makes comics out there should pay attention to this. The new kids, the millennials or whatever the fuck you call them, your kids, Scott,
yeah,
they don't give a shit about ads and they don't want more shit.
Yeah,
they really don't. They don't need a fucking another DVD or another book or a thing on the shelf, but they do want to support you. The number of people that will come up to my table, say, I'm a big fan, I've been reading for years, I don't know what to say other than here, and slap money on my table and want nothing.
Yeah.
Is growing.
Yeah. I had some of that in the Salt Lake City Comic Con and I did not know what to do with that information.
Let me give you a print. Let me give you a book. Please. No, I don't need another book. I don't know. I don't need to put another print on my wall. I just want you to have,
yeah,
I just want to pay you for what you made.
There's something to that for sure.
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting to see how this all evolves. I say, embrace it, bring it on, whatever.
Yep.
Do what you got to do. Gotham happened on TV. Who has not seen it besides me?
I seen the first one. I didn't see the follow-up.
Okay, yeah, I've good. Seen the first one.
Good, good. Then you guys have things to say. So is it, I mean, I'm not that I'm hesitant. I've just been busy, but I will catch up on it. I definitely want it to be good. I'm always concerned about a project or even a comic book, which is weird offshoots about before the hero that you came to this book for in the first place, there were these cops or whatever. I'm not sure how I feel about that idea in general, because I feel like, you know, the reason anyone gives two craps about Gotham as a place is because Batman's there. So when you do a thing where Batman's a kid or not involved or like even Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I feel like part of the reason I just don't care all that much is because none of the heroes I care about are doing anything in there, because they're meant for the bigger thing. So How does this hold up, Stephen? How are you feeling about it? What do you think?
I think it needs a little focus. Now, again, we all only saw the pilot episode, so we don't know what they changed from the pilot episode to last night's episode.
Yeah.
But my take was focus on the crime procedural, get rid of Poison Ivy, Catwoman. There was probably one other. And then I really, sadly, was not impressed with the Fish Mooney character. So, you know, make a couple of those changes. I think it'd be really great as a police procedural if they ran it. Not like The Wire, but ran it like what was Baltimore, Homicide, Life on the Streets.
That was a good show. Yeah.
Yeah. If they ran it like that, it'd be great.
But then what's the point of it being Gotham then? You know what I mean? Like, why not just call it the Rough Streets of Chicago.com?
Because there's an awesome series called GCPD. Yeah. Gotham Central. That was fantastic. That focused on police officers doing police work in Gotham City. And yes, they occasionally had to run up against the Penguins or the Victor Zazzes of the world, but they ran it through the police precinct. And if James Gordon is there to clean up the city and get away from the Falcone family, then that's what it needs to be focused on.
Mark, and, you know, to be honest, I liked it. For me, a story like this, I'm not just going to watch a cop show. I'm not really interested in CSI, NCIS, all those crappy shows. I know people like them. I don't like them. But the one way to get me to watch something like that is to throw in a little bit of the storylines and maybe, you know, alluding to certain characters that I'm familiar with from comics. And that's a way to get me to watch that show that I normally would not watch. Even if it's just throwing a nerd bone out there or something like that, it's something I would watch because of the background characters.
Yeah, and I guess I would go against my own thing I said earlier, which is more hypothetical, but I really, really like offshoot Star Wars stories that have nothing to do with core characters. Like, if you want to tell me about a stormtrooper and his life and times, that's very interesting to me.
Yeah.
So if they can, you know, if they can pull off the feel and the whatever that Gotham is supposed to have, then awesome. Scott Kurtz, what did you think of the pilot?
I like James and I like Bullock. I don't care about the Batman mythos anymore. I think the parts that turn me off are not the parts that turn everybody off. Everyone hates that Edward Nygma is the forensics guy and the Penguin is this goon. And it's like, hey, he's the Penguin and this guy's the Riddler and here's Poison Ivy and wink, wink. It's fine. Put him in there. It's cool. What I like about that especially is that it would be great if they are actually mixing up the mythos. It would be great if the Riddler wasn't just some villain that was, you know, told riddles, but if he was this weird guy that worked in the police department and he was a forensic guy, at least now he's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And the Penguin is kind of this side mob guy and he doesn't like being called the Penguin. He's just kind of a weird dude, but he's kind of psychopathic. That's would be nice. I would like to see a twist on things for once, maybe do it differently. Yeah. But, I believe that James Gordon has bigger problems than worrying about a promise he made to Bruce. I just don't fucking buy it.
Yeah.
I agree that the Fish Mooney character is probably a little too comical to be scared of in a day and age where we have characters like on TV, like Hannibal Lecter and just some of the badasses on even like Sons of Anarchy and even shows like The Blacklist. Like, it's just a little too, she's just a little too comical to feel that she's scary. But I like what James Gordon is going up against, and I like the idea of him trying to figure out how to be a good man in a corrupt town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the overall vibe, right? Like, the place is corruption rife with it. And yeah,
it's just like, it's so deep. He thought he was going to be coming and clean it up, and he immediately gets wrapped up in it. So,
I like that actor. He's cool.
He's a good actor, and I think, and he's a good young James Gordon. The problem is that I don't know why Bruce is involved. You know what I mean? Like,
that's the part I'm talking about with wedging it in. I get the criminals, but just making it such a big deal with young Bruce. And I haven't seen it, so, you know, whatever.
I was going to say, it depends on where they go with it. If it's just a little side thing that they throw in there once in a while, it may not be so bad. But if this becomes his core motivation to satisfy this rich kid, you know, and have this agreement with him, it might start to get a little weird.
The Wayne murders could have been a huge case that was arcing the first season, because you could set up Thomas and Martha Wayne as very, very important people in the city, and that their death has been makes this void, and there's this power shift, and the whole thing is centered around that. But we didn't get that. We just got that they were this this rich family on the way back from the movies, and you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean,
the part of the mythos you're sick of.
Yeah,
I still like Batman a lot, and I'm cool with Batman. I'm cool with his mythos.
You're the guy.
Well, I think look, they've milked the hell out of him, but I still think he's my favorite kind of hero, archetype of hero. I like a guy who's a little messed up. and he kind of represents, he's sort of the leader of that AA meeting, but I'm with you on that. You know, you can only, how many times can you show that flashback or have him be afraid of a bunch of bats in a cave? I'm kind of done with that.
There's a great video online where someone took all the different videos, TV shows, and movies where the Wayne family is getting murdered and mashed them into one video.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. It's like, how many times do we have to watch the Waynes die?
Yeah, it's a lot of death. All right, well, that's still on. I'm going to all watch it and have more to say in a couple of weeks when we get back together.
You should watch it.
Supergirl headed to CBS. Steven, what's going on with that, and should we be excited about that?
I think the most interesting thing about this is that CBS hasn't ordered a pilot. They've gone ahead and given a full go-ahead to a series.
Mm.
So that could be the good thing. The bad thing is, I hope they learn their lesson from the failed Wonder Woman series.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was saying on that day you were on TMS talking about this, that they've had so many DC properties spread over so many networks.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool.
And it's almost like it kind of came out of nowhere. You got Marvel over there needling around with S.H.I.E.L.D. and movies. And then all this time in the background, all right, so we're coming off Smallville and all that, but we got this Flash coming up. We got Arrow in production still, season 3. We got this new thing and this other new thing in Gotham. And it's not like it's all WB either or CW or whatever. It's everywhere. Everybody's got a DC show, which is so weird to me.
Yeah, even TNT has given an okay for a Teen Titans pilot. So.
Right. Which is interesting. I'm more interested in seeing what they do with that almost than any of these, because they're out of the network system and cable gets to do funky shit sometimes. So
I don't think they're going to go full AMC.
No.
Type stuff.
No, but they might. They have an opportunity to do something more edgy because they just can. Yeah. I don't know that means that they will, but that's at least interesting. And now there's also news, a Deadpool movie on the way.
Yeah, that'll Deadpool be good. Movies that's actually got a release date. So,
Boo is right, because look, I don't want to do the overly simplified, if it's not rated R, it's not any good. But I kind of think it won't be any good if it's not rated R.
It's going to be hard with Deadpool.
Yeah.
He would thrive in a rated R environment.
He's a freaking, cussy, bloody mess. Like, PG-13, dude, come on. And isn't that confirmed? Didn't somebody come out and say?
Yeah, somebody said that they were not going for an R rating. And in today's movie environment, you want to stay away from anything that is going to limit your audience. And with more theater owners and parent groups getting upset when, people are underage that go into an R-rated movie, then, studios are going to back down and say, well, let's make this PG-13 so we can get as many young people in the seats.
Does what's his name get money for any time Deadpool's used? He does.
Yeah,
all right.
He does.
Well, maybe none of this should happen then. No, it's fine. He's fine.
His Twitter feed just lit up the day that he was talking. He talks a lot about those kind of things. So.
Why does anyone like that character?
I don't. I really don't.
I burned out on
him. I kind of like him. I think he's fine.
I like him in small bits, but once you get past the shtick of what Deadpool is, it gets old after a while.
Yeah, it's doses. You don't want him too much all at once. That's for
it's
sure.
It's so, like, for the audience of, like, just blow it up and say a dumb thing and waka waka. And it's like, for every kid that plays Grand Theft Auto, they get to see, I don't know.
It
doesn't
never been
seem
your
like
bag.
There's much of a point to him. Yeah.
There's a few there. I find some, it depends on who's writing him. You know, sometimes it's a little bit deeper and a little cooler, and other times it's just all flashy explosions and smart ass comments. So.
Yeah, it's basically talking like Spider-Man with bloodier outcomes, really.
I think that's why I like it, because it's like a dirty Spider-Man in a way.
I see what you're saying.
You can go get one of those in Tijuana, right?
That's why I like. That's why I like.
Sign me up, sign me up for the dirty Spider-Man.
That's right. That's why I like Saga a lot. I feel like it's a dirty Star Wars, basically.
Yeah.
All right. Guardians of the Galaxy made all the money. That's the only other story we had, really.
Yep. Still making money.
Made a shit ton
still of money. Still making money.
And there's a bunch of other little things, but we'll cover more of that next week. I want to make sure we get Scott in and what he's been reading before we go. So here's this.
The stolen plans of the Vibrator were destroyed, along with the only two criminals who knew how to operate it.
Scott Kurtz, did you read any comics between last time we spoke?
No, I've been reading books.
Oh, that's good, though. What books?
Well, I've been reading The Dresden Files.
Oh, yeah. Very
good things about that.
You know, I love it. And it's kind of pulpy, and it's kind of it's been around for a long time, so I'm very new to it. I'm late to the game. But there's just a ton of books. Butcher is it's interesting to read about how he got his start, and how that first book was practically like a school thesis. But I love the rules of magic in it. I love the character, and I'm really digging.
Are you just reading the first book right now? Because that's where I'm at. I'm about halfway through the first book.
No, I'm on like book four now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then I'm also reading a book to share in my wife's fandom, because she's, you know, my wife's a geek and she loves all this stuff. She loves Guardians of the Galaxy. She loves the Marvel movies. She loves Godzilla. She loves all of it. Lord of the Rings. But I've never seen her fangirl out about something the way that I fanboy out about stuff than I have with this series Outlander, which is a 20-year-old book series.
Mm-hmm.
But I started watching the TV show with her because it just became a show on Stars. And yeah, there's romance in it. It's a little romancy probably for most dudes. But as a lover of what is known in the industry as chick flicks,
yeah,
I have no problem with romance. And Outlander is a good series, and the book is good, and I'm enjoying it, really, really enjoying it. And it just had its mid-season finale, but it's historical. It's about the English versus the Scots and kind of the end of the clans and the Highlander, and it's essentially a time travel story. So it's like scratching my Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour, Somewhere in Time love, and then there's a little Highlander and Braveheart in there, and there's a little history and a little time travel, and it's really good. And on top of it, guys, if your wives are super into Outlander, you can share in their fandom as well. When we watch Game of Thrones, she'll turn to me and I'll be like, well, in the book, and give her just that little extra, you know, like that she didn't know because she has not read the books.
Sure.
And it's the exact opposite for Outlander, although that mid-season finale pissed me off and I have to read the book now. I just can't wait till April to find out what happens next.
I think that's awesome. Real quick, if you like chick flicks, where do you stand on Hitch? I hate that movie. So where do you...
It's not a good movie.
It's
bad. You mean the one with Will Smith?
Yeah, it's garbage.
That's a terrible movie.
Okay, good. Just making sure. I don't want to...
It's a garbage movie.
Yeah. It's genre notwithstanding, it's poop. All right, good. Like I feel a little bit better about feeling that. All right, cool. Well, those sound good. I want to get into the Dresden stuff I've been meaning to for a long time.
You'll really dig it.
All right, well, good.
The rules of magic are super cool.
I like good rules in books. I like established universal rules that hold up over.
And I know that Dynamite has done some comics of it too, but I can't speak to whether those are good or not.
I enjoyed. That's how I got into the books, was because I read I forget when the Goblin Ghoul or something, the Ghoul Goblin, and I was like, ooh, I want to read more about this, and so that's when I started getting into the book.
The Goblin Ghoul. It sounds like an Italian film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I caught up. I've been reading Saga like a wild man. And that is to say, I'd only read one issue before and really liked it and then got behind and just never kept picking them up. And I decided to play some catch up. I'm only, I think, maybe six, seven issues in, eight maybe. I've just met the grandparents. If anyone knows where that is, that's where I'm at. I love that series. I don't know. I waffle back and forth on, do I like that they're street talking in this fantasy sci-fi universe? And then sometimes I think, I am so glad they street talk in this sci-fi fantasy universe, because it's just such a weird contrast that it somehow works. But there are moments where I'm like, yeah, you spaceman, you probably wouldn't have said that unless you lived in Brooklyn or something. Like, I don't know. Some of that stuff sometimes gets under my skin. But man, what awesome art. What great writing.
It's a really weird world.
It so is. And the fact that they ignore the weirdness half the time. Yeah. I think that's what works, right? That's what makes it funnier, I think. And then they'll be having a bunch of dialogue and go, you know, you realize there's like a 8-eyed shirtless spider lady standing behind you right now. But they are all just like, meh. I'm hungry. You know, like it's just not a big deal. It's weird. Yeah. But I love it.
Sometimes it's a good liter. It's an easier literary device just to use modern day references and don't explain why, because it's easier to get the feeling across.
Because you don't have to explain it. You don't have to do a bunch of exposition about fantasy things that you've never heard of before.
So, like, did any of you watch Deadwood?
Yeah, same thing.
One of the big questions was, well, did they curse that way? And they're like, we looked it up. And the cursing back then was Yosemite Sam talk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, you yellow-bellied, what's, you know, side-swander. It would have sounded dumb. So, yeah, they put in...
Didn't they shoot, like, part of the pilot with the old... stuff and it just wasn't working or something. I've read something on Wikipedia about
that. They might have. But you know, it's like the movie A Knight's Tale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where they put modern day music in that because every time they researched the music of the time, it was like to the kids of the time, this was David Bowie. And he's like, well, if we play this, no one is gonna get that. So why don't we just play David Bowie?
Yeah.
No. Because that's you know what I mean? So yep,
totally agree. And it works here, I think, in lots of ways and creates emotional connection to characters that I wouldn't otherwise have.
I like that better. I like, you know, when that people will insert fake curse words mm-hmm. like fracking and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I hate
that. That yeah. takes me out of it so much. Like, so I appreciate when they do things like this because it makes me just feels more believable, even if it's not. You know, obviously they wouldn't have that in that world. If it actually existed, things would be different.
Sure.
But you have to, especially when you're doing, using words and things that express emotion and things like that, I need to hear things that relate to the way people talk. Yeah. You know, it makes more sense.
I totally agree with that. But then there's this other side that you like to also get your hands in, which is, you know, phrases like, And this takes a lot more exposition, but phrases like, you know, winter is coming or, you know, everybody referring to each other as Sir, S-E-R, and then, you know, whatever. There's a bunch of that in the Dark Tower series with Stephen King, the language of it. Those are things you could only get from reading those books. And there's something special about having that knowledge, too, like getting with your friends who are also fans of it and kind of sharing in that it's kind of got its own language as well. Yeah. But I think
it can backfire on you, though, because, like, there's a lot of people who just do not like the language of Firefly.
Yeah, and I love it. Well, that part of the reason I love it though is because it sounds like a Western to me, and so it resonates with me. But if you don't like Westerns, that would probably suck.
But do you like it, like all the shortening and the cursing in Chinese and all that?
No, the Chinese part I'm not really into because I don't know Chinese. Maybe
I thought that was so clever.
But I like the whole, you know, she's really harsh in my calm, or you know, phrases that sound like some guy just got off his horse and said that. That stuff's great to me in there. But it does, you're right. It can backfire. Some people don't like that stuff. It's working for me in Saga, and I'm super hooked, and I'm going to keep going until I'm caught up or done. Are they done, or are they still going? What's the deal with that book? Does anyone
it's
know?
Still going.
Still going.
It's still going. That's why I haven't started it, because I just want more, a bigger chunk to read.
Is that Brian K. Vaughan's core mm-hmm. thing he does now? He's not, there's not a, some, I thought there was some other big deal he was doing. I don't know why I thought that. I don't know. Maybe not. By the way, that movie got canceled. Did you hear about that? The Why the Last Man deal?
Oh, yeah. Trachtenberg's movie got canceled?
Yeah, Trachtenberg is the one that leaked it. He did some interview and said, yeah, it was budgets and people and suits. And the 10 reasons that most movies get in trouble and then don't get made, it wasn't creative differences or anything like that. But sounded too bad because...
That seemed like a risky choice, too, for a director for a movie that big.
And a brand new director. At least, you know, he, in his own words, he was, you know, new to the thing, but he's got some other cool thing going. So I'm sure Dan will be fine, but I was really curious about that adaptation and how that would actually work. I think it would actually make a better TV show, but that's just me.
Scott, hey, speaking of Why the Last Man, did you have trouble thinking of the character, the primary guy in Saga, and not think about the character in Why the Last Man?
He's very similar. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like almost, at least initially, almost exactly the same sort of personality.
Well, one has horns. One has,
other than visual.
Yeah. One has horns, the other doesn't. But honestly, you're right. They're the same kind of.
I kept hearing the voice of the other guy.
Yeah. And then even some of the female characters are very, very close to some of the ones he runs into. And that's, yeah, it's obviously his style. And that's great. And I'm cool with it. It's like a Michael Cera movie. He's going to be he's going to be George Michael and everything he's in. You just have to be kind of cool, you know, okay with it. Yeah. I liked it though. All right, Mark, you always delve down and find weird shit. What'd you get this week?
Yeah, off the beaten path a little bit. I read, well, not really. A lot of people know who Bob's Burgers is, but they have a comic book out, and I'm a big fan of the show. Nicole and I really enjoy watching it, so I figured why not read it? And, you know, the only disappointing thing about it, it is a lot of the standard, you know, all the Belchers are involved, but the problem is there's not enough Bob in this thing. It's basically a collection of a couple different smaller stories that involve Linda and Louise and Tina's erotic friend fiction that she writes, which is, you know, can be hilarious. But there's hardly any Bob in this Bob's Burgers comic book. So, and I looked at what's coming up in issue 2. I haven't read issue 2, but it doesn't look like there's much more. So it's a little weird. I was just expecting more Bob.
Like the Simpsons books and stuff where you feel like this was meant to be on a TV screen moving and it doesn't have the same characterization and stuff? I always struggle with these. Like, it's always hard for me, even as a fan, it's hard for me.
Yeah, it does to an extent, but I think if you, with things like this, if you watch the show enough, and maybe that's what they're relying on, is the fact that your brain is going to fill in the gaps. Your brain is going to put the voices into these characters, the inflections that would make it funny if you were watching it on TV.
Yeah.
So it might be depending on that a little bit, but overall, yeah, I think that is definitely present. But I need more Bob. So hopefully it'll get a little bit better in that sense, but very much gives you the vibe of watching the show. The art is perfect. It looks like something that was taken right off of the television screen.
I love the cover art. It looks different enough to be cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then they're going to play with things that they wouldn't have time to deal with in the show. So that should be pretty cool.
Cool.
And I also read something that was basically a collection of a webcomic, Unemployed Ant. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that.
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's Stephen Prince writes it. And basically, Eddie Antley has been laid off. And this is a strip about his pursuit of employment and kind of seems to be like it, you know, wants to be a commentary on how, you know, the unemployment rate today and how difficult it is to actually get a job. The art is very sketchy looking and very funny in some cases because you've got ants with hairdos that you normally wouldn't see. And it's, you know, very interpretive in that sense. But my problem with it is that it's not funny enough. It's the opportunity for all kinds of puns. Like, remember when I read Poop Office, as goofy as that was?
Yeah, I remember.
There were so many goofy puns, and this is not something that should even be taken very seriously in the first place. So I want these puns like shoved down my throat, and they're really not there. If you took the ants away and read this story, it would just be a story about a guy who's unemployed and his wife hates him because he doesn't have a job and constantly busts his ant balls. it's just a boring story about unemployment, but it could be made very funny with enough puns and enough weird things like, oh yeah, that's right. This is an ant colony. And there's funny things that I haven't really thought about as we try to make them human in a way.
So this is a book version of, I assume this is like a webcomic or something.
Yeah. It looks like a webcomic that's just been collected. And the book just has, you know, the strips put into each page, like 3 per page.
Yeah.
So you have the punchline at the end of every panel. And overall, like I said, it could be very good. I just wish there was more funny and goofy and ridiculous puns in it. So I won't be reading the second collection, but it is something that you can go to. Let's see. It's unemployant.com if you want to read some of the current stuff that's out there.
Weird.
Not even a good play on words for the title.
Yeah, it's a weird Unemployant.
Yeah, Unemployant. And when, you know, his name, that's what I expected, because the dude's name is Eddie Antley. And I think on the cover, it says, "Will work for sugar."
Yeah.
You know, so like little things like that I would expect to be, you know, peppered throughout. They're not really there. It's like if you weren't looking at it and just reading the dialogue, you would have no idea that that ants are saying this.
Well, sugar, because the ants love sugar. Duh.
Yeah. Right. And then there's a couple, but in the entire read, I think maybe a handful of times where there are references to, like, I think his mother or something says about how you have a lot of brothers and sisters, and there's a picture of the mom with like thousands of spawn behind her. Yeah. You know, so that was a funny moment, but there's just not enough of that to make me want to read it again.
It's got another book called Monster Matador. I don't know what this is, but interesting. It looks like more long form, same kind of art style. Something about a matador.
Huh, interesting. I'll have to look at that.
I don't know what's happening.
And let you know.
All right, let us know. Snowpiercer, did you finally crack that open?
I did. You know, I started reading it last night and realized I wasn't going to get far enough into it to say anything meaningful today. So maybe next time I'll talk about it. I did see the movie, which I enjoyed. Nicole read Snowpiercer. It's basically two volumes of what do you call it? A thing. And she said it was great. She's like, you've got to read this and talk about it on Comic Dork. So I'll get back to you. She says it's much better than the movie and wishes they would have made the movie more about the graphic novel than they did with.
That's funny.
Did that thing start as a graphic novel?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think
it started as a graphic novel.
Korean thing or Japanese thing or something?
No, it was European.
A French graphic novel.
Oh, okay.
To Wikipedia.
Cool. Oh, I'm thinking of the Korean director. That's why I'm thinking Korean.
Yeah, I think there's a Korean version of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. And the director is a Korean guy. He's the guy that did The Host, that crazy monster host movie.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. I've heard nothing but good things about the movie. So if you tell me really?
I hated it.
The movie was okay. Like, it could have been great. It had that potential for what I always related to as Mad Max, where it's this like post-apocalyptic world where shit's just weird because people's lives are so, they're put into this like horrible situation and people just become nuts. And they worship the train because the train is the only thing that keeps everybody alive. There are so many cool things that could have been done with it. There were great moments, but I overall was not happy with it. I don't want to spoil anything with it, but.
Wow. I've heard nothing but praise. That surprises me. I haven't seen it, but
it's worth watching, but there are some sort of, if you like tend to overthink your plot points and movies, there are points where you'll just go, why'd they do that? You know,
overall,
it's worth watching. I think.
Wasn't there a lot of, trouble with that movie where the even Chris Evans was fighting because the studios wanted to change a lot because they just felt like audiences weren't smart enough to understand what was happening, so they dumbed it down.
Yeah, they did.
Plus, there was released to direct a video first or something, and then
it was released at the same time as it went to direct video, and that's what surprised me because it had like 96% fresh rating. I was like, what is this movie?
Yeah.
And every time I looked at it, I knew it was stupid, but you know, the publishers had been contacting me saying, hey, you should read this book before you see the movie because they changed a whole bunch and we're not happy with it and da 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 da. And I flipped through the book. I thought, oh, this is an interesting concept. But then when I watched the movie, I was like, well, this is a dumb, dumb, dumb movie. And you're right. They probably dumbed it down too much.
Maybe.
There definitely wasn't enough depth for the motivations and how things are going to happen. And the ending drove me nuts.
Me too.
Again, I don't want to spoil it, but the ending was just like
I'm out.
Am I supposed to be hopeful with this? This is ridiculous. Mm. So, yeah.
All right. He just needs a shield and he could have solved the whole thing in one fell
swoop. Would have been better.
Steven Schleicher, what are you reading?
I'm kind of like Scott Kurtz. Last time we talked, I was like going to read through all these comics. I haven't had time, but when I sit down on the exercise bike, I do flip through some books, and I've got four of them that I'm going through or about to start. For those fans of the True Detective TV series, there is a collection called The Yellow King that collects the story that they're talking about in that show and a bunch of other stories. And it's different. If you kind of want to know what the hype is about with that, you can think of the person who wrote The Yellow King as the precursor to H.P. Lovecraft. Mm. And so there's some interesting things there in the world that he creates is rather interesting. Because I want to just learn more, I'm always looking for things. I'm also reading Save the Cat, which is, you know, how do you write a really good how do you write a sellable motion picture?
Mm.
So that's interesting. I do have up next is Words for Pictures by Brian Michael Bendis, which is kind of a how-to guide into getting into comics and writing for comics in the industry. And one that just landed on my Kindle reader last night, Steven Johnson's new How We Got to Now, which is really cool. If you're not familiar with that, his last couple of books looks at events in history and things in history that changed the way that we work and do things today. So, you know, how we got the printing press, Gutenberg, he was a failed winemaker and he got stuck somewhere in, I think, Istanbul. And he had all these parts laying around. He's like, well, what can I do with this wine press? And that came up with the printing press.
Oh, cool.
So I'm really interested to see how we got to now with Steven Johnson and see what's coming up with that. So it's not comic related necessarily, but there are some things out there beyond just the four color comics that are worth reading too.
Absolutely. Very nice. Well, that pretty much concludes things. Thanks everybody for joining us. If you want to catch us on the next episode, you sure can. Make sure you go to comicdorks.com because that's a great place to go. Anybody around the table have stuff got coming up? Scott Kurtz, anything people can do? See Table Titans, anything, whatever you got.
Right now it's just PvP and Table Titans.
Yeah. Keeping busy.
I'm.
October's a good month, man. Right? Because there's less crap going on.
It's good. The next couple months are good. I know that Steve Hammaker just got done recoloring all of season one of Table Titans so that it'll match season two, and we're going to start publishing the book now that we kickstarted in the spring. Mm-hmm. We were hoping to have it out by the winter, but we had this opportunity to have Steve recolor it, and we decided to go for it. So now it'll come out early in the spring, the book, but I'm excited to get this book made. We also have a couple of new items that are coming out. The Scratch Fury dice bag is out. Anyway, if you go to our PvP site and click on the store, you can see all the new stuff we have coming out.
PvPonline.com, everybody.
Thank you.
And, of course, PvP Online on Twitter and all that. Steven, MajorSpoilers.com, anything else?
Yes, the Major Spoilers Costume Contest. The deadline is October 10th. Get your entries in. All these people who want to enter as Francis Automan, go ahead and do that. Look forward to seeing all of those. And the winner gets an iPad Mini. So there's some incentive right there.
Good Lord, man. And, nice. And if they come out with a night, this is the great thing. If they get up on stage and announce a new one, a Touch ID or whatever fancy new thing the new one has, that's the one they'll get.
The Mini, yes.
Very
but
cool.
If they come out with a 12-inch monstrosity, you're not getting,
you're not getting
the iPad Mini.
Awesome. What else are we doing here? Oh, Mark. Hey, what's going on with you, man? Anything?
Actually it's October, so it's that time of year where we do our yearly charity build for woodworkers fighting cancer. And this year we're actually aiming for $15,000, and it's for the Cancer Research Institute. And the idea is we build a project together. It's very simple to build with some basic tools. So even folks who aren't really, you know, consider themselves fine woodworkers can probably build this thing. And the idea is every time we get one built and they send us a picture, we have sponsors that have pledged a particular amount of money per completed project. So it's essentially a way of passing all the financial burden onto, you know, big corporations to help us get that $15,000. So the build will be starting very soon, October 17th. The video will come out, and you can also donate if you want to, or if you're a company that's interested in sponsoring, we can get you signed up for that as well. So everything's at woodworkersfightingcancer.com.
Very cool. Go check that out. Of course, the Wood Whisperer on Twitter.
Yep.
I think it's going to do it, guys. Email us, comicdorks@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter as the show at comicdorks. Comicdorks.com is our website. Go to frogpants.com for more great shows like this. That'll do it for us. Until next time, we'll see you then.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.